sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. For the next hour, we'll be serving up news, music, comedy, and conversation. You know, the war in Ukraine continues to upend millions of lives, and one Jewish organization has been there from the very beginning, providing life-saving aid and hope. This morning, Rabbi is joined by David Weisberg, the CEO of World Jewish Relief, to talk about the organization's work in Ukraine and the people whose lives are being changed every day. And we'll have a quick chat with our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. You can email your comments to us, tojewishradio18@gmail.com, or visit us on the web at tojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This coming week, we'll begin the final month of the Jewish year, Elul, bringing this 5786 Hebrew calendar year to a close. It's been, to say the least, an interesting year for Jews, and by interesting, I don't mean necessarily in a good way. There have been some remarkable highs and many more problematic lows. As we complete the month of Av and head into Elul, Rosh Chodesh, the new moon that commences the month, is this coming Thursday and Friday, it's worthwhile reviewing the last 11 complicated months and coming to a couple of conclusions about just where we Jews sit right now. Let's start by exploring what's happened in Israel and the Middle East over the past very active 11 months. First, shortly after the Jewish High Holy Days last year, in October of 2025, the last living 20 Israeli hostages were released by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in an extraordinary deal negotiated by President Donald Trump's representatives. By January of 2026, the remains of the final Israeli victims of the Palestinian terrorism had been recovered, and essentially the Gaza war was over, albeit with Hamas still in control of what is left of Gaza. If anybody believed this would be the beginning of a peace process, however, they were mistaken. While large-scale warfare in Gaza ended, the IDF remains deployed there, albeit predominantly around the outside of the territory. There have been no further flare-ups of full-on fighting, but the Israeli military continues to work to destroy the terror tunnels and the large military infrastructure that the Hamas terrorists and war criminals constructed underneath Gaza. Many Gazans, of course, remain displaced or inhabiting temporary structures that replace their ruined homes. While a variety of plans have been advanced to disarm Hamas, the Islamist terrorists that brought all this disaster to their own area and onto the heads of their fellow Palestinians, Hamas is not disarmed and has rejected all the plans to do so in one way or another. Israel remains very wary and has taken measures to remain in control of Gaza. By the way, nobody in Gaza is starving or has starved in spite of all the inflammatory rhetoric you hear. Israel supplied a huge amount of food and water as well to Gaza residents throughout this war, which is remarkable if you think about it, feeding your enemy's civilians throughout a war. In any case, from the autumn until nearly the end of February, things seemed to settle down in the Middle East. I was in Israel back in November of last year, 2025, and I can attest Israel was pretty much back to normal, at least for a while. Streets were busy, new buildings were going up everywhere, the incredible dynamic energy of a small, intense, immensely accomplished country was palpable. And then, on February 28, 2026, the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran, the committed sponsor of Middle East terror and Islamist international assassinations and murders all over the globe. This was the first time Israel and the U.S. went to war together. In the two earlier Gulf Wars, Israel was asked not to join the coalitions assembled against Iraq, since the Arab states allied with the U.S. could not at the time abide being seen as participants in an alliance with Israel. at the beginning of the Iran war, in short order, the long-term murderous leader of Iran, Khamenei, was killed in missile, air, and drone strikes, as were various leaders of Iran's military, while Iran's nuclear installations and ballistic missile locations were struck hard. Iran, however, retaliated, attacking Israel, the Gulf Arab states, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, as well as U.S. installations throughout the Middle East. Israel struck Hezbollah, Iran's terrorist proxy in Lebanon, and that has been an ongoing war ever since. You are no doubt aware that initial American confidence, or overconfidence, voiced by President Trump, stated that the war would be swift and effective and the brutal Shiite Islamist regime of Iran would collapse. Well, in spite of the death of many key leaders in the Iranian military and intelligence regime, the regime did not collapse, and the Iranian closure of the Straits of Hormuz caused severe disruption of international oil supplies. A kind of long-term standoff has occurred subsequently, with the U.S. and Iran on and off negotiating and blowing things up. The standoff, with regular flare-ups, has destabilized the region even further. The Houthis in Yemen, another Iranian terrorist proxy, are trying to close another key shipping lane. Meanwhile, U.S. bases throughout the region have been struck by Iranian drones and missiles, some fired by Iraqi terrorist groups allied with Iran, others by Iran itself, and the U.S. seems to be running short on its most powerful and effective armaments. As yet, there is no clarity as to where all this is headed, and the U.S. public has demonstrated very little support for an ongoing war with Iran. Some Americans, perhaps many, blame Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu for quote-unquote talking Trump into the Iran war, which is on the face of it absurd, but might actually have some foundation in truth. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, where the U.S. military has never been involved, Israel has severely damaged Hezbollah, but not destroyed it, and the IDF has taken regular casualties in doing so. Hezbollah, too, is not disarmed, even if the Lebanese army would like to disarm it. It's all quite a mess. And it's completely unclear that anybody associated with starting this Iran war had any notion Iran might have some tricks up its billowing sleeves. Imagine. Simultaneously in Israel, the clock is ticking towards an October 27th election for the government. This will be a referendum on Bibi Netanyahu's long tenure as prime minister, particularly because of and ever since October 7th, 2023. While the election falls into the Jewish year 5787 next year, not the end of this Jewish calendar year of 5786, it certainly is a dominant topic of interest for Israelis and Jews everywhere. On the surface, it looks like Netanyahu will lose the election, and a new government will be formed without him as prime minister. But that has been the case before. And typically, Bibi has found some magical political way to end up back in the driver's seat. Still, this very much does look like Bibi's last stand, the end for his government, which would lead to a serious Israeli national examination for why the October 7th disaster took place at all. And some accountability, finally, will be in store for the Netanyahu government for that incredible failure. Well, that's Israel. Next week on Two Jewish, we'll look at just what happened to Jews in America over the last 11 months and all around the world in this 5786 year. It has been one of the most challenging and trying for us during a series of trying years. We'll explore the effect those events have had on Jewish experience and identity, which has been both complicated and troubling. And in a couple of weeks, we'll explore what all that means for being Jewish in the coming 5787 year. Now, my friends, we have a tradition we must uphold on this episode of Two Jewish. Friday is the first day of the month of Elul, which is the final month before Rosh Hashanah, holiday of the shofar, Yom Teruah. In Jewish tradition, we blow the shofar, the ram's horn, every day of the month of Elul, to remind ourselves to prepare for the coming of the time of return and repentance. Hearing the sound of the shofar is a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days. It's an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. And so, I brought a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us into the Two Jewish Radio Show and podcast this morning. Well, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you surely must be so by now. To play us in a little differently musically in the week of Rosh Chodesh Elul, the beginning of the new month, starting our four-plus week preview of High Holy Days music, here is a little bit of the High Holy Days coming up, a medley of Areshet Sfateinu melodies from the Rosh Hashanah Shofar service, coming up a little less than 5 weeks from now, on Friday night and Saturday, September 11th, and the morning of September 12th. Cantors Barry Braun and Ezra Scher singing an Areshet Sfateinu medley for the coming holiday of Rosh Hashanah about 5 weeks from now. You can join us, Congregation Beit Simcha. Go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, to join us for the High Holy Days this year. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be David Weisberg, CEO of World Jewish Relief, a historic organization that has helped refugees and people in need throughout the world and is now doing great work in Ukraine during the brutal war of invasion that Vladimir Putin launched. We are now 4 years into it. Meet David Weisberg when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. David Weisberg is the Executive Director of World Jewish Relief USA. He has spent more than 30 years leading nonprofits locally, nationally, internationally, in a variety of areas, including social justice, humanitarian work, communal service, and environmental work. And we are going to talk about World Jewish Relief. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. It's really an honor and privilege to be on. I'm so glad to be joining you today.
Thank you. All right. So tell us what World Jewish Relief is. I know its history goes back to the 1930s, but I'm not sure that everyone's familiar with the organization.
Sure. And most folks in the U.S. Are probably unfamiliar with World Jewish Relief. Its presence in the U.S. is rather new. We've had an existence here for just 3 years, but World Jewish Relief actually has a track record that began in 1933 when the British Jewish community organized to rescue Jews who were facing persecution in Nazi Europe, in Germany and Austria. And at that time, rescued 65,000 Jews to the UK, which included playing the pivotal role in rescuing 10,000 children through the Kinder Transport.
Right, the Kinder Transport, of course.
And resettling them in the UK. And instead of just disbanding after that horrible part of our history was over, instead the community said, we came together to support people in crisis, and we're going to continue to support people in crisis. And so has evolved over 93 years to what is now known as World Jewish Relief, one of the foremost Jewish humanitarian organizations in the world, very solidly committed to the notion that our Jewish values tell us to lift up all people in crisis, both Jews and non-Jews, with an equal sense of urgency, which today means working around 20 different countries around the world, impacting approximately 150,000 people a year, and a lot of that work right now is in Ukraine, which I'm so pleased we'll have the opportunity to discuss today.
We will indeed. I just want to note that historically speaking, World Jewish Relief worked in rescuing Jewish communities fleeing Arab countries and the former Soviet Union and the Cold War Eastern Bloc countries. In Eastern Europe, when the wall fell, it did a tremendous amount of work. But as you noted, not a big presence in the United States. And when we come back this morning on Too Jewish with David Weisberg, I want to talk about what brought World Jewish Relief to a larger presence in the U.S. and what's going on in Ukraine right now. All that when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established nearly 8 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. every week with full music, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9 a.m. and services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them, and followed by a tasty Kiddush. You can also come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson, and come to all of our extensive Adult Education Academy classes, including Introductory Judaism, Zohar, the Crown of Kabbalah, our Book of Samuel class, and many others, all taught live and on Zoom. You can access those through our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, the coming Jewish High Holy Days, our fabulous religious school, and our youngest Torah Tykes program, Bar Bat Mitzvah Confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18 at Gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com, T-O-O JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. 500,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So one of my favorite synagogues to visit in Jerusalem is the Halevi Synagogue, which they call the Syrian Synagogue, but it's also the Alawite Synagogue. But what it really means is it's Jews from Aleppo, and such an interesting and different and beautiful service. People talk about Jews that originate from Syria as though there was such a thing as Syrian Jews. But in fact, there are two very distinct communities.
Right.
And there have significant populations in various places around the world, including New Jersey, but also in Mexico City. And you have some information about that.
Right. Well, there's a very funny stand-up comedian who does a routine about getting an Uber in Mexico City. Somebody advises him, now you should probably take the Uber Magen David because you're Jewish. And he said, there's a Jewish Uber? And a whole routine starts about this. But there's a key phrase that many people listening to this completely lose because they don't know about Halevi. And here's the point. There are large populations of very wealthy Syrian Jews in Mexico City, in Panama City, in Bogota, in San Jose, Costa Rica, and they are deeply divided, like the old divide between Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazic Jews in Israel, between these two communities that hail from cities that are not very far apart from each other. One is Damascus, the capital of Syria. The other is Aleppo, which was the capital of the Ottoman province, of which it was a part. And people from Aleppo are called Halabis because the Arab word for, maybe the Turkish word, I'm not sure, word for Aleppo is right. Halab. And the fact is that the overall culture in Damascus is much more Arab-oriented, and the overall culture in Aleppo is more Ottoman-oriented. A lot of traces of sort of the legacy of Ottoman culture.
Yeah, and you know, in the Halevi Synagogue in Jerusalem, everybody wears a tie and usually a coat, which in Jerusalem is unheard of on Shabbat morning, but they all do it there. It's very interesting, very Ottoman.
Right. Well, Aleppo was this hugely sophisticated city. It had a vast an important Armenian community as well, a Jewish community, Turkish community. It was a real cosmopolitan center. And I think this clip, if people can find it or if they have found it, is just hilariously funny. But understanding the distinction between Jews whose distant origins are in Aleppo and Jews whose distant origins are in Damascus is key to understanding the humor of this piece. And it's useful as you go through that part of the world, if you're going to do anything with the Jewish community, to at least understand the distinction and how far apart these two communities consider themselves. And in the current context of all the resurgent anti-Semitism everywhere and whatever, it's amazing that sometimes the worst hostilities can be between two very closely related major elements of the same Jewish community.
To everybody else, they're Syrian Jews, but not to the people from Aleppo or Damascus originally.
Right.
Even if they've been in the New World for generations.
Yep.
By the way, I think the comedian is Zach Margs or Zach Margolis, and we'll try to play some of that clip for you later today on the show. Tom, thanks so much, and we will talk next week.
A pleasure as always.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A lady's walking down North Fairfax Boulevard in Los Angeles, a very Jewish neighborhood. A man jumps out at her in a raincoat, stops in front of her, opens up the raincoat, and flashes her, shouting, "Hey, lady, look!" The woman shakes her head slowly and says, "Oi, what a terrible lining." That was the very old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice, including one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof, justice, justice, you must pursue. In the Torah, which has no extra words, no kefel lashon, the repetition of a word means it has additional importance and power. Here the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. We must find a way to remove our own ego needs in any judging situation and seek not self-justification, but true justice. Sometimes we must even admit that our processes of justice can result in unjust decisions and unfair punishments. That, too, is part of seeking true justice, of being just. But even more than that, the Torah teaches we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase after it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Each one of us is enjoined to pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there is no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our leaders or our government to act well. Sometimes we need to be forcibly reminded that on many issues, injustice remains, even prevails. We must continue to work seriously to rectify this, and so to pursue justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Seek, no, chase justice in your own life. Strive for justice in your organizations and institutions. Work for justice in your society, and only then will good follow. It is a great and holy message in a society like ours. in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the only goal, but the better pursuit, indeed the most meaningful real pursuit for us, is justice. May our actions and our words help make our society more just this coming week and in the coming new year of 5787, just 5 weeks away. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, David Weisberg, the CEO of Jewish World Relief USA, will tell us how we can personally help to establish more justice working in the ongoing crisis in Ukraine and how they are trying to make a difference worldwide. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
In U.S. elections, an anti-Israel and perhaps anti-Semitic candidate narrowly won the Democratic Senate nomination in Michigan, while a virulently anti-Israel and quite likely anti-Semitic candidate was drubbed in a congressional race in Missouri last week, up and down. The mildly good news is that U.S. Representative Wesley Bell easily defeated former Congresswoman Cori Bush for the nomination in the heavily Democratic district in St. Louis. Bush was one of the first members of Congress to falsely claim Israel was committing genocide in Gaza, and AIPAC helped fund her defeat at the hands of Bell, who won re-election this time with less AIPAC support than last time by some 20 points. In Michigan, however, the story was different. Abdul El Sayed won Michigan's slugfest of a Democratic Senate primary, clinching the nomination in a close race over Representative Haley Stevens and establishing a kind of Midwest beachhead for a progressive left on the march during this midterm cycle. El Sayed has advocated ending military sale to Israel and been associated with anti-Semitic podcasters during his run for the Senate nomination. El Sayed overcame nearly $65 million of outside money and an establishment in Michigan that rallied around Stevens. Popular Governor Gretchen Whitmer endorsed Stevens late last month, a move seen as a last effort to stop a rising El Sayed, and it nearly worked. While El Sayed had a large lead early in the race, his margin of victory ended up a little less than 1%. El Sayed, a former public health official, goes on to face former Representative Mike Rogers, who claimed the Republican nomination without opposition. Their race in November is expected to be one of the most competitive in the country. It could determine which party controls the Senate. Whoever wins will succeed Senator Gary Peters, a Democrat who decided against seeking a third term and endorsed Stevens in the primary. Stevens conceded the race, said that she had called El Sayed to offer him my full support. President Donald Trump addressed Abdul El Sayed's primary performance during an interview, claiming candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America or its members will ruin our country. You go to these cities that are taken over by the socialists and the communists, they're always filthy, dirty, they're disgusting, Trump claimed. He added, aside from crime, aside from all of the other problems, no jobs, no anything, no money, they're always filthy, disgusting, dirty, and that's what you'll get. Okay. El Sayed has not been endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, but Democratic Socialist lawmakers like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders campaigned for him. El Sayed told the Wall Street Journal he is not technically or practically Democratic Socialist of America. Mike Rogers and National Republicans signaled they considered El Sayed an easier opponent to beat than Stevens would have been. The National Republican Senatorial Committee went so far as to produce a digital ad emphasizing El Sayed's progressive credentials and endorsement from Bernie Sanders, a move viewed as an effort to boost him into the general election where they think they can beat him. Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez barnstormed the state for El Sayed, whose push for Medicare for all, condemnation of money in politics, and criticism of Stevens for supporting aid to Israel were central to his campaign. This primary was seen as a test of whether an insurgent populist movement that has scored victories in primaries in blue states like New York and Colorado could have success in a purple battleground state like Michigan. Like other Democrats who have run to push the party leftward in recent years, El-Sayed accused Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. That's a particularly relevant position in Michigan, which has a large Muslim and Arab American population. El-Sayed frequently blasted Stevens over money she accepted from corporate PACs and the TV air cover she received from big spending allies, including $30 million from a group affiliated with AIPAC. In other news, a major fire at one of the largest kosher meat processing plants in the U.S. is poised to increase the price of kosher meat ahead of the High Holy Days, in addition to devastating the local community. Investigators in Postville, Iowa, said the fire that devastated AgriStar Processing started accidentally in the facility's laundry room. The fire destroyed 75% of the plant, put more than 600 people out of work, said the fire chief. The fire also interrupted a linchpin of kosher meat production, according to OU Kosher, the oversight agency run by the Orthodox Union. The damaged facility means a significant portion of kosher beef and chicken slaughtered and sold in the U.S. will not enter the kosher supply chain, said Rabbi Moshe Elefant, the organization's CEO. Kosher consumers will feel the impact of the tightening supply with the reduction of availability. Elefant said OU Kosher was working to find solutions to ramp up production at other plants, warning that the crisis could fuel bad actors. Unfortunately, when supply is limited, it creates opportunity for unscrupulous individuals who seek to make money preying on the well-meaning kosher observant public, he said. Jared Bernstein, the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Greater Des Moines, said the fire was a terrible situation. The impact on the local community and business will be large. This fire is not the first time that a crisis at AgriStar sent the community into a tailspin. Back in 2008, I remember it well, a federal immigration raid at the plant, then known as AgriProcessors, netted the arrest of hundreds of workers, leading to the arrest and conviction of the company's longtime CEO, Sholem Rubashkin, on 86 counts of bank fraud, mail fraud, and money laundering. It led most of Postville's Jewish residents to leave. It had developed an unusual stronghold of Orthodox life in eastern Iowa. Saying many people believe Rubashkin's 27-year prison sentence was excessive, President Donald Trump commuted Rubashkin's sentence during his first term in 2017. The conviction remains. Canadian Jewish billionaire Heshy Friedman purchased AgriProcessors and then reopened it as AgriStar. He did a great deal after being urged by Jewish leaders to ensure competition in the kosher meat processing industry. As he said, it wasn't done for financial purposes. It was done to really cater to the Jewish community, Friedman said. During the time Rubashkin was closed, the price of beef roughly doubled. After we acquired it, it came right back down. Friedman also said he shored up the company's employment practices and made improvements to the slaughter processes that had made AgriProcessor a target of animal rights activists. AgriStar appreciated the first responders who worked tirelessly and selflessly to protect lives and contain the fire, and the employees who showed inspiring care for each other, but they don't know what's going to happen to the plant. We understand there are many questions about what comes next, AgriStar said. While we are still gathering information, evaluating short-term plans, we're committed to sharing updates as soon as they become available. We appreciate your patience. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, David Weisberg, who is the head of World Jewish Relief USA, a very important organization that has increased its presence in the United States. Tell us a little bit about why, not so much the shift, but the emphasis in a World Jewish Relief USA aspect to what has, you know, principally been a British charity.
Sure. You know, I think there's really two motivating factors. One is that the level of crisis in the world is too large for the resources of the British Jewish community alone to respond. And so in order to expand our impact, it requires us to expand our reach as well. I would also suggest that World Jewish Relief offers unique opportunities for impact, and as someone who believes that one of the most powerful mitzvot we can do in the world is to give others the opportunity to realize their dreams and visions for building a more beautiful world, that bringing World Jewish Relief to the U.S. and offering members of the U.S. Jewish community the opportunity to make impact in the many various ways that World Jewish Relief does is a mitzvah. It's I think, wonderful to be able to offer those that opportunity.
You have been active in dealing with Ukrainian refugees. I encountered some of them in Poland when I was there years ago now. It's extraordinary how long and deep this crisis has become. Tell us a little bit about the kind of work you guys are doing there.
Sure. You know, the work that we're doing now when it involves Ukraine, first of all, we are indeed continuing to support people who are fleeing Ukraine, whether they're coming to the UK, and we support folks who are coming to the UK from a variety of countries, not only UK, but Afghanistan and Syria, and many coming now from Hong Kong, but also providing support in many different ways for the folks who are remaining in Ukraine, both Jewish and non-Jewish. I'll get to the one that I want to talk about most last, but as examples, there are so many internally displaced people in Ukraine. And so we're training internally displaced people to find new livelihoods so they can continue to support themselves and build new lives in new homes in different parts of the country. We're providing programs for older adults. We're doing dementia work in Ukraine. We're doing really remarkable work to partner together psychologists in Israel with psychologists in Ukraine to train them how to do trauma counseling, which sadly psychologists in Israel have so much more experience doing. We're working with organizations that deliver vital goods for living to people who continue to live in cities that are close to the Russian border. And so all of that is part of the many puzzle pieces of the work that we're doing to support both Jews and non-Jews in Ukraine. But a program that we were doing in some sense before this war started, now in its fifth year, but for which the importance has only grown in magnitude, is our work in doing home repairs, and particularly now our work in repairing war-damaged homes. I was in Ukraine 8 years ago, and at that point, going around with the JDC, visiting, you know, 70 and 80-year-old folks who live on a fifth-floor walk-up, and their monthly pension barely pays for their food and their medicine and their utilities. I was back in Kyiv in February, in the dead of winter, with World Jewish Relief, visiting many of those same types of folks, the 70 or 80-year-old up the fifth floor walk-up whose monthly pension doesn't pay for their medicine and their food and their utilities, but now their windows are also blown out by missiles that have landed across the street. They don't have operable heat. They have electricity maybe 2-3 hours a day. These are folks who are not able to run down 5 flights of steps every time there is an air alert, so they're huddling in their hallways or on their kitchen floors. And so we're working with our local partners to repair people's homes so that they can continue to have a life, so that they continue to have some sense of safety and security and warmth. And sadly, particularly in the past month, when the level of Russian attacks have only increased in the month of July, there were over 600 missiles sent from Russia into Ukraine, more than twice as many as had been the previous monthly high, and over 650 people killed and over 1,000 people injured and countless homes damaged. It is a struggle to keep up with the rate of devastation there. And so what we're working to do is give folks in the U.S. and the UK the opportunity to be empowered to make a tangible difference in the lives of people who are really bravely but very vulnerably continuing to live in Ukraine.
You know, it's one thing to rebuild homes that have been damaged after the war. It's another to rebuild homes while missiles are still landing. That must put a tremendous level of stress and strain on the people doing the work as well, doesn't it?
Incredibly so, and I so appreciate your saying that. One of our partners who we work very closely with in Kyiv just a couple weeks ago had her apartment was affected by a missile attack. The next day, she's out in community assessing other people's needs and moving forward with these projects. The attacks are started to come increasingly during the daytime, making it really scary for people to go outside. We had a report just a couple of weeks ago of a staff member, a social worker, with another NGO that we work with, I think in Zaporizhia, who was killed and whose 10-year-old son was injured. And it's really, it's such a testament to the bravery and the compassion of these folks who are out there doing the work. And we're doing the best we can do to work side by side with them and to empower them to keep moving forward. The other challenge is, you know, supply issues and cost issues. I just heard today that the wait for replacement windows is now up to 6 weeks. And as supply issues go up, cost issues go up as well. But, you know, these are not needs we can walk away from. In addition, as things like supermarkets are getting hit, food supplies are becoming challenged.
The process of being essentially the supplier of support for the efforts going on the ground, is it more complicated working in Ukraine than in other places? Because you guys have to transfer funds, bring people in. Are there complexities there that we maybe don't understand?
You know, there are complexities in travel. There's complexities just, you know, you can't fly to Ukraine
right
anymore. So when I went to Kyiv back in February, we were originally supposed to go to Odessa, fly to Moldova and go from there. It was a point where it was unsafe to go through that route of travel. So we had to go to Poland and take a train there from Kyiv. So, you know, the navigation is a challenge. Every country. Unique complications. I just returned a week or so ago from Georgia, where there's not a war, but has its own unique complications when it comes to providing support. But certainly doing it within a war where we know that our partners are themselves going through trauma is an additional level of challenge. And doing it in an environment where the rate of damage accelerates, unfortunately, at a rate that the increase in support is very strained to keep pace with, is a challenge because it requires making tough decisions. You know, one of the reports that we got from our partners in Odessa is that they're no longer telling folks, oh, you'll be on the schedule for your home to be repaired in 2 or 3 weeks, because we don't know what's going to happen in those 2 or 3 weeks. And so definitely different challenges in working in a country that's actively in a war. And you know, let's be clear, actively in a war that is not a war that the people of Ukraine would have ever chosen.
Of course. It's an aggressive war by Putin. I mean, everybody needs to understand that if they don't.
It's aggressive. I think part of what folks need to understand is while Ukraine is fighting very valiantly and I think feeling more and more confident in their position in this conflict, the more valiantly they're able to fight, the harder Russia will strike.
I know that World Jewish Relief helps people of all religions and backgrounds, but just for the listeners of Too Jewish. How large a Jewish population remains in Ukraine?
I would say the current estimate is 30,000.
30,000 Jews still in Ukraine.
Well, you know, it also relies on varying definitions of who's counted as Jew.
Of course, you know, as everywhere in the former Soviet Union and behind the old Iron Curtain, you know, it's very interesting finding out who considers themselves Jewish, who's considered Jewish. So obviously you work directly with families in the Ukraine, with people that are affected. The Ukrainians, refugees from this war are scattered kind of all over the region now, really all over Europe. Does World Jewish Relief help them in other places?
Absolutely. And, you know, we certainly support families who have left Ukraine for neighboring countries. There's a very powerful story of a mother and daughters who were living in Odessa, who escaped and moved to Moldova. And one of the daughters was so traumatized by the attacks in Odessa that she stopped speaking entirely. And one of the things I think that World Jewish Relief does particularly well, because of our size, because of the nature of our partnership relationships, is we're very nimble in being able to provide the specific care that folks need. And so in that family's case, we were able to identify a speech therapist in Moldova to work with that family. And that daughter is now speaking again because of the intervention that we were able to provide. And so that's, you know, in Moldova, that is in Georgia, that is in Poland, and of course that's in the UK as well, where there's probably the, you know, in terms of numbers, the largest number of folks who have left Ukraine that we're supporting are folks who are in the UK.
I want to thank David Weisberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Tell us where people can go to find out more about World Jewish Relief, World Jewish Relief USA, and all the work that you guys are doing.
Absolutely. You know, and I would say, I think one of the most important things that we can be doing in our work is that it's easy to watch something like the situation in Ukraine, to read about it in the media, and to say, I feel concurrently desperately sad and completely helpless. And our job is to help folks not feel completely helpless and let them know that they can make a difference. We've started a platform where folks can adopt a home in Ukraine for repair for $3,600. Go out to their circles and ask their friends and family to contribute $36, $50, $100 so that they can all tangibly make a difference and repair someone's home together. You can find more information about that at usa.worldjewishrelief.org. And if, you know, if everybody does just one house, what a difference we can all be making together.
Thank you so much, David, and good luck with all of this great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Rabbi, and thank you for what you do and for flying the flag for the people of Ukraine and for World Jewish Relief.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be cantor Carl Sayers, exploring how composer Leonard Bernstein sampled Jewish music from Slichot in creating West Side Story. Should be a lot of fun. And please join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush. In person and on our Facebook page, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, for services and classes, our High Holy Day schedule, and to sign up your kids for our new Torah Tykes membership. It's great fun. Our playout this morning comes from Mordechai Shapiro and Akev. Their song for the coming month of Elul, I Can Do Better. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
If I had a dime for all the love that I share, would I be a millionaire? I think I would be nowhere near. If I built a ladder on the good that I give, would it go up to the heavens or be broken beyond repair? Hashem knew, but God knew, 'cause I knew I could do better. My Father, forgive me, we'll do better.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.